on Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy. Today is March 15, 2007, and we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2867.
The chair has just arrived.
The chair has just arrived.
Do you want to change the order?
So, Sandy, would you like to let us know about 2867?
Sure. I think. Madam Chair, members of the committee, 2867 comes from Representative Greenlick as a primary sponsor. This bill is modifying the current definition of dental hygiene to include their abilities for assessment for and to apply dental sealants and fluoride. It deletes the current requirement of 5,000 hours of supervised dental hygiene, a dental hygienist clinical practice within the previous 5 years as an educational requirement before obtaining a limited access permit. And it authorizes the permit holder to assess the need for and to apply the sealants, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. This has no revenue impact, and we don't have any fiscal information at this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sandy. So let's start some testimony, and we have Paul Cosgrove here. Actually, can we start with the Board of Dentistry?
How about we start with the sponsor?
But that would be fine. Would you like to?
I would at least like to introduce you, ma'am.
That would be fine, Representative.
And my preference, if I may, would be this from here. Would that?
That would be fine.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I've been working with hygienists through the last two sessions to try and create a rational basis for expanding the services of dental hygienists, particularly in areas of special need. And there was an attempt at the Board of Dentistry to get some expansion. We hoped we wouldn't need this bill. And Mr. Cosgrove could tell you more about it. It was a pretty non-controversial expansion, including such things as allowing dental hygienists to apply fluoride and dental sealants. One of the parts of the Healthy Kids Act is to create the opportunity for many more kids to have sealants as a very important public health process. It turned out, for one reason or another, that the board wasn't able to deal with the expansion, and we'll have testimony from the board. We can ask them why, but if we want to. But the fact is, this bill is a very modest clarification and expansion, and really moves us much more rationally into the 21st century in terms of how dental hygienists generally and expanded function dental hygienists can serve the public in a way that needs to be served. So I really appreciate you taking the time to hear this today, Madam Chair. I thank you for not making me get in a walker and get in an uncomfortable chair.
No problem.
And I look forward to the testimony.
And thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Greenlee. Hopefully we can get this issue resolved. Can we start off with the Board of Dentistry? I have Sir Patrick Bratz. Here you go. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Welcome, and introduce yourself for the record. And
thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patrick Bratz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and I thank you and the members of the committee for allowing me to be here today. I'm just basically have just some brief comments, and they're being passed out to you. 2867 came to our attention last week, actually. I forwarded off to all the members of the board and have had a variety of the nine members correspond either by email or by telephone calls regarding comments, concerns, questions, whatever. The board has not officially had a chance to sit down as a nine-member board and look at the bill or any amendments that may come to it. To actually give their specific position, but when this issue came up recently, as Representative Greenlich had mentioned before the board some various issues, the board felt that they were prevented based on current statutes of doing some expansion issues regarding some rules. And so we pledged at that time and continue to pledge that we'll sit down and work with the various stakeholders in trying to come up with some language that everybody can at least come to a compromise on. We'll obviously do whatever the legislature wants. The board will enforce whatever statutes are put into place and write whatever administrative rules are necessary. So I don't have an official position from the board on 2867 as it stands now. I have bits and pieces from members of the board, but none of them have had a chance to actually talk to each other as well because we haven't had a legal meeting at that point.
Thank you. Any questions? I have one.
Sure.
I understand that the board hasn't looked at the bill. Could you illuminate us on, you know, the general take on the definition of dental hygiene? I mean, this is not the first time this issue has come up. So, you know, the willingness of the board to reach some resolution on this issue, you know, back and forth with the attorneys is, you know, that's where we're at, and what we're doing is trying to resolve some of it.
I think the board is very willing to sit down and look at some language to do this. What they felt, and based on advice from their legal counsel, is that to expand certain rules were contrary to certain statutory authority and certain statutory definitions, and that those definitions needed to be changed. And we've thrown around, I've shared with Mr. Cosgrove and some others, some possible wording changes. They've shared some back with us, and we haven't had a chance actually to sit in a room and talk as a group to do that. And so, I mean, I don't think the board is actually opposed to doing this. I think they want to make sure if they do it, that it's done correctly and the wording is right. We had a similar situation a couple of years ago where there were some changes going to be made. We had not had any input into it and found out that the sponsors of the bill, had the change gone into place, would have really been to a detriment to them because they had a wrong word in a comma in a certain place. And so that's why we're saying, you know, if you give us an opportunity to look at it, we can tell you, yes, this will allow us to do this or it won't allow us to do this based on the definition.
Thank you. I appreciate your candor.
Sure.
Representative Greenlich?
I assume that board was an open hearing, so it's on the record which statutes you think
prevent it.
Could you tell us which statutes?
Specifically, it's the definition of dental hygiene. And I don't have my. If you bear a second, I can get the Practice Act.
We can probably track it down here too. Dental hygiene means that portion of dentistry that includes the rendering of educational, preventive, and therapeutic dental services, period, right? No.
No, it goes on.
Scaling, root planing, curettage, and any related intraoral or extraoral procedure required in the performance of such services. Now, the sense was that didn't include something?
No, it's, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlich, it's actually sub 4, dental hygienist. It means the person who, under the supervision of the dentist, practices dental hygiene.
Yeah.
There are specific duties that the dental hygienist has to be under the direction, either general or indirect supervision, and what was being presented to the board would have been allowing them to do this without supervision, which would have been contrary to sub 4. And so that's where we were talking about making some changes to that, unbeknownst that 2867 was already in a drafting stage.
May I follow, please?
You may.
You're not talking about expanded function dentist, hygienist, no. You're talking about regular. So hygienists now do scaling and root planing and curettage and other stuff under the supervision of a dentist.
Sure. And Representative Greenlich, yes, that's correct.
And these other things would still be under the supervision of the dentist? I mean, in the same, at least the extent to which those are?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlich, I think the issue was that they wanted to be able to, especially for the Healthy Kids program, to be able to do the sealant program without a dentist having made the diagnosis or the assessment. And the board felt that based on the language that said they had to be under the supervision, they felt they could not draft a rule that would allow them to do something contrary to statute. And so that was where the board left it, as saying, I think we need to fix this statute, came up with a couple verbiages, but then subsequent to that, 2867 was introduced, and I think that's why we're here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And glad to hear that the board wants to work with us on this.
Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove? Welcome. Please let us know who you are. And
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. And if I might, I'd like to just step back a place from the wording and share with you why the bill, the goals of the bill. And the goals are really two, and the handout you're receiving states them in a little more detail than I will do. But one is to expand the availability of sealant in other oral health prevention programs. And that's what dental hygienists are trained and educated to do and licensed to do, and that's one of the goals of the bill. The second goal of the bill is to make it easier for limited access permit hygienists who practice without supervision, often in community health programs or in rural areas or in Head Start programs, those kinds of things, to get to apply for their permits. So if I can just briefly expand on those two goals with a little bit more detail. You've heard a bit about the legal question and the wording, but regardless of which words we put in which of these definitions, what we would like to make clear is that, and this is an issue on which, in theory and in principle, both the Oregon Dental Hygienists and the Oregon Dental Association were in agreement, because we were the ones who petitioned the board to try to get this resolved. We believe that all dental hygienists, whether they have limited access permits or not, ought to be able to be out in the community doing sealants and fluoride without supervision. So we will work together with the board and all the other interested parties to make sure we bring you the right words that achieve that result. Obviously, you've heard before, and you have the dental health officer at the state who I think has signed up after me, about the importance of oral health and the oral health problems that we have, especially with kids, but also with other populations, and the scarcity of resources to deal with those oral health problems. And this is at least one part of what we believe is the answer to some of those problems. So that's the first purpose, expanding sealant and other oral health programs. The limited access permit hygienist, if I could turn your attention to the second handout you have here. I have a new little computer. I've never run a PowerPoint, so I printed it. See, so I wouldn't have, as Sandy, your administrator, suggested, this was probably not the time to try to do the piece of technology and have it not work correctly.
Excuse me one second. Speaking of technology, if folks could all turn off their cell phones or whatever, because that affects the mic system here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. Limited access permits were first made part of the statute back in 1997. And since that time, there have been a number of changes in the scope and the functions of a limited access permit hygienist and in the initial prerequisites to be able to apply to become a limited access permit hygienist. But that's when we had the start of independent practice, meaning non-supervised practice by dental hygienists in the community. On the second page of your handout, it talks about the requirements in order to become a limited access permit hygienist. First, you must have graduated from a school and get your regular dental hygiene license. Second, you have to have liability, professional liability insurance. And then in addition to what you've just taken in school, you also have to have 40 additional hours of education in those subject matters mentioned: physical diagnosis, general medicine, pharmacology, oral pathology, etc. And there are also additional continuing education requirements that limited access permit holders have beyond what a regular hygienist has. And then on that fourth bullet of the 5,000 hours, that's the second issue that this bill addresses. Currently, you're not eligible to even apply, even if you've done all those other things, until you've been out practicing in the community for 5 years, and you have to have 5,000 hours of clinical practice within that 5 years. It's a barrier in this respect, twofold. One, in some Oregon communities, especially small rural communities, dental hygienists often work less than half time, and mathematically they will never then get 5,000 hours within 5 years. And we have a number of examples of that's happening. One was a hygienist who had 20 years' experience and worked in Astoria, but was never able to reach that qualification. The second thing is hygienists are coming out of school very well trained and very eager to help in the community. Limited access permit hygienists, generally speaking, don't have very many of their services reimbursed by third-party insurance or, for that matter, in general, under our Medicaid program, for a reason I'll be glad to explain. So it's not as if the independent practice is a great financial boon to them, but if they're eager and would like to practice and help out in those Head Start programs and WIC programs and county health departments and schools, we'd like to be able to get them out a little bit earlier. Obviously, any number of hours is somewhat arbitrary, 5,000, zero. We will be proposing an amendment to the bill to move it from the current zero to 1,000 hours as sort of a compromise to make sure that before you apply for a limited access permit, there's some additional clinical experience beyond what you received in school, but not as much as currently required. The thing, though, that I wanted to point out, and I know that when Dr. Impey was here and Dr. Gary Allen from Willamette Dental Group, they talked about mid-level providers in the oral health field. But this second, the next page starts to give you examples of some of the current limited access permit holders in the state of Oregon and what they're doing. And I won't go over that in detail, but we're very proud of the work that people like Zena Burt, who's working in Albany-Corvallis, and works with the county health department there. Marlita Corliss, who's in Lane County and working at a federally qualified health center, working with kids and toddlers. Marlene Horde, who is at, I can't remember where Marlene is from, but one of the other communities in Oregon. Diana Porter, who's down in Josephine County, working with WIC programs. And Diana Strand, who's over in Bend, working with elderly people. This is an example of the kinds of services these folks are able to do and why we think this is an important part of helping Oregon meet its oral health problems. I would be glad to stop here and answer questions. The only one other thing I would like to mention is I'm authorized to tell you that the Oregon Rural Health Association is a supporter and has endorsed the bill. Madam Chair, if there are any questions.
Thank you, Paul. Just for the record, you know, one of my goals is to make sure we're expanding access, and I think this is one of the routes to do that. So I'm really pleased we're having this discussion today. Any questions so far on the presentation?
Did you mention anything about the Oregon Dental Association's position?
Chair Kotek, Representative Green Lake. I don't want to speak for the Oregon Dental Association. They have a representative in the back of the room. Did happen this last year when we were trying to resolve this by rules was that the Oregon Dental Association and the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association petitioned the board for a rule change to permit all hygienists, either limited access permit or otherwise, to work in community programs doing sealants and fluoride. We joined together in that petition, which was the one that was turned down on a legal basis, not on a policy basis, is my understanding. So I think in principle on that issue, we are united. Does ODA have a specific position with respect to the language in this bill? I wouldn't suggest I know the answer to that question.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And I look forward to getting your amendments on the 1,000 hours. We don't currently have anyone from the ODA signed up specifically, so if you'd like to, let Aaron know. Could we have Dr. Empey and Dr. Love come up together? Hi, welcome. We're friendly.
Thank you. I know. Yeah. Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Gordon Impey. I'm the dental health consultant for the Public Health Division Oral Health Program. I'm also wearing another hat today. That is chair of the year-old statewide oral health coalition, a broad-based coalition of advocates supporting oral health. And they are in support of this legislation, as am I, with regard to House Bill 2867. And the reason I'm in support of it is the bill addresses, or author, the piece of it that I'm particularly interested in and supports our program with the oral health program is that portion that authorizes limited access permit hygienists to assess the need for and apply dental sealants in schools and other facilities where underserved children are unable to receive regular dental services. I'll just summarize my my testimony. Currently, the Oregon Dental Practice Act rules require a dentist to assess a child for dental sealants in a school-based setting prior to receiving the sealants. LAP dental hygienists may then place the sealants without a dentist supervision. By allowing LAP dental hygienists to assess the need for and apply sealants, the oral health program's school-based dental sealant program would be able to reach more schools, more underserved children due to the an expanded pool of dental providers in order to utilize. The oral health program's dental sealant program targets schools with high numbers of children on free and reduced lunch program in order to ensure that we are reaching those with limited access to preventive dental care services. In many of our targeted schools, particularly those in rural areas, we have a difficult time finding dentists to provide the sealant assessment screening that is needed because of geographical distance issues. LAP hygienists are fully trained mid-level providers. Research has shown that dental hygienists are qualified to assess teeth for sealant placement and eligibility. Lastly, allowing LAP hygienists to screen for placement of sealants in school-based program enhances the Public Health Division's ability to meet the national benchmarks, including the Healthy People 2010 goal of the percent of children with sealants. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. MP. Any questions for the doctor? Hi,
April. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm testifying also in favor of House Bill 2867, and I'm dealing with this as a very personal perspective.
I'm in the record.
I'm sorry?
Your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. April Love is my name. I'm in the unique position of being a dentist who has previously been a dental hygienist. And in school, the major philosophical difference between the two disciplines is that dental hygiene students are conditioned in school to be responsible for preventing oral disease, while dental students primarily engage in treating oral disease. When I retired from practice 5 years ago and volunteered to do dental screenings for public programs dealing with low-income kids, I was shocked. I had never seen so much decay, and there aren't enough dentists around to be able to fill the cavities that I've seen. I'm going to skip the next two paragraphs because they're too emotional for me. I've gotten involved since in many prevention projects, but I found that there isn't anything I can do as a dentist that I couldn't have also done as a dental hygienist. Access to care isn't the whole solution to Oregon's oral health problems. We have to drastically reduce the need for dental treatment through prevention programs. And because people in high-risk populations often can't get to us, we have to figure out ways to get to them, especially children, in schools, churches, and community centers. Dental hygienists are already doing this across the state, but need an expansion in the services they can provide, especially in rural areas where there are few dentists available to treat disease. For example, I work with the Multnomah County Sealant Program, which is run by dental hygienists and expanded function dental assistants. It's a great program that applies sealants to 5,000 low-income second and third graders every year. A way it could be improved, though, is to allow hygienists rather than a volunteer dentist to determine the need for a sealant. If a child is absent the day that we go in to do the screenings, when the time comes, usually the next week, to do the sealants, that child doesn't get any because they haven't been screened by a dentist. If hygienists were allowed to assess the need for sealants, the program would be much easier to administer and the kids wouldn't be left out. The other problem with using dentists is that we tend not to agree with each other, and we're not calibrated with each other, so there are inconsistencies in the assessment for sealants. You know, that really is a problem, isn't it? He set up the program. In addition, I work as a clinical dentist in the PCC dental hygiene program, so I know firsthand the high caliber of the educational program and also of the students themselves. Because entry into the program is so competitive, the students tend to be older, have had prior education, often have worked as dental assistants, and are extremely motivated. Because they are required to do community outreach in school, they graduate believing they have an obligation to continue serving their communities. There are few in every class that would prefer to work in public health programs rather than in private practice. I believe that they should be given the opportunity to do so after completing the educational requirements necessary to obtain a limited access permit. It's going to take a lot of work to improve the oral health of Oregonians, and we need to encourage as many participants in that endeavor as possible. Thank you.
I just want to thank you for all the work you're doing for kids and their oral health needs.
Well, these two paragraphs that I didn't read are the reason why
I know. You take this
that
very seriously.
That needle thing is awful.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Dr. Love and Dr. Empey, for your testimony. And I know you don't want to answer a question, but I'm going to ask you one anyway, because you brought up in your written testimony and said you believe they should be given the opportunity to do so after completing the educational requirements necessary to obtain a limited access permit. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if either of you would care to express an opinion about the proposed change from 5,000 hours to 1,000 hours for the supervised clinical practice requirement.
I'm actually speaking totally on myself. I'm not representing anybody in my answer, is that the caliber of some of my students that are graduating right now, taking the extra classes for their limited access permit, I would put them in a lot of the public programs that I've already worked in. But I know that it's, so I'm kind of even saying that I'm not even sure the 1,000 hours is even necessary in private practice, because what they do in private practice is way, way different than what most of these public programs are all about. But I say that's just my own yeah. observation.
Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici. My own personal, I've worked for years with public health dental hygienists, and my own personal opinion is that dental hygienists can, in fact, have the capability to screen for sealants. They always have been able in this state to be, or for years and years, been able to place sealants. The question is whether they can screen for them, and in my professional opinion, they're capable and qualified to also do that, as are LAPs, and that the reduction in the hours shouldn't make a great deal of difference in terms of their ability to do that, or in terms of protecting the public.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Good question. Other questions for? Thank you. Thank you for being here. Mr. Hamilton would like to.
There you are.
Thank you for being here.
Welcome. Thank you. I wasn't quite prepared for this, but my name is Brent Hamilton. Representing the ODA, Oregon Dental Association. And I'd like to speak just briefly, Madam Chair, about the intent of the bill and to kind of reinforce what Mr. Cosgrove was saying. The original intent was to work together as the two associations to deliver a rule, a concept that will provide better access to children through the sealants and fluoride varnish. That is all very much the same, and the intent's still there. But the issue that we have a little bit now is that it seems that some other things have been attached to the bill that we just don't find acceptable. I think it's been already discussed is the 5,000 rule for the requirements for the LAPs. We feel that experience is needed before entering the field. And although I agree that education is good, but experience is also good. There are not too many medical professions that we send people into the field, direct into the field, without some practical experience. And the original intent of the LAP was to have experienced hygienists going out to the field, going to places where we lacked access in delivering that care. So in a way, why we kind of look upon this is saying, well, if the original intent was the LAP to go out, have experienced dental hygienists go out and do some work, then why are we eliminating the 5,000 hours now? So that's basically the point I want to make. We're very interested in looking at the amendments when they're let come about, and hopefully have a dialogue with that and come to an agreement so we can provide better oral care for our Oregonians.
Thank you. And thank you for your feedback on the concerns of the association. Other concerns of the bill, is it just the hours?
Well, there's also the there's a portion of the bill and the originally spoken of. I with all hygienists working in the community and school-based programs, the understanding was, from my understanding, we're talking with people who were at the meeting, that was the LAPs who would be providing the care. I'm not sure. I don't recall or receive the feedback that it was all hygienists who would be delivering the care in the school-based and community programs. Now, I might be wrong on that, and if I'm wrong, I'd like to be correct. One of the issues was we want to deliver the best care we can to the people in these programs, and we don't want to send people who are not experienced to the schools and providing care for the children unless they are qualified and experienced to do that.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to work with ODA and the hygienists to come back with language that will satisfy both their needs.
Madam Chair,
I just want to make sure that somebody's working also on the definition of dental hygienist, because that seems to be where part of the problem is. That's where the problem came in.
Yeah, maybe. We'll get with the LC and we'll look into that. That'd be great.
Well, thank you. And
The fear was that the board didn't have the ability to make rules under that definition, but we're dealing with it statutorily, so it might solve the problem, or it might not. I'll see what we find out.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, and I appreciate the representative for agreeing to head up a small work group to work on this. Informal work group. I want to pass this. I want to have greater access. I want to figure out how we can get this done. So I hope you all can work together quickly and come to some agreement.
Yeah, I'd like to have it solved so we can get it to the full committee by a week from Friday.
I'll leave that up to you. So thank you for being here, Brett. I really appreciate it. I close the public hearing on 2867. And I'm going to go out of order, and I apologize. But I would like to open a work session on 2524. I'm going to lose one of our committee members, and I want to make sure he's here for some of this discussion. Yes, Sandy, could you review the bill for us, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, subcommittee members. House Bill 2524, you recall, requires health care facilities to collect data on health care facilities' acquired infection rates. It specified the type of infections we had, a public, and other items are in the bill. It directs DHS to establish an advisory committee to assist in the analysis of quarterly reports. It had an emergency clause with an effective date of July 1, 2007. We had the public hearing on this on February 15th. What you have behind your SMS are a -1 and a -2 amendments that we have the requesters of those amendments here to speak to those amendments for clarification. And we also have the -3s that, to my chagrin, we got at 10-3. So some of the interested parties had just seen them as long as we have, but they are prepared to speak to that to the best of their ability for the committee for explanation.
Thank you, Sandy. And Representative Greenlee, would you like to give us a status update?
Yeah, I'll give you a report.
Under your, yes, your right hand.
I met with the Oregon Patient Safety Commission to ask whether they would like to take some specific responsibility for this. It turned out that it was not the direction that they would like to go, although they would like to be involved in the advisory committee and advising in the process. I met with Dr. Cohn, the state epidemiologist, and I met with the folks at the Office of the Oregon Health Policy and Research Office, they were very much interested. That the epidemiology group were happy to advise OPFR, I also met with the Hospital Association. The bulk of these amendments come from the Hospital Association. Perhaps Gwen would like to talk about it. This is the first time I've seen them in this form, but I have seen them in other forms before, and I think they move us a really long way. I've also passed them on in the earlier form to Representative Tomei, who seemed quite happy with the fact that we were moving forward. I had not talked to the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'm not sure what the logic would be to leave long-term care facilities out, but maybe I would be willing to accept that. The dash one, the dash two, leave out long-term care facilities in the definition on page one of the bill, and the second exempts anybody from reporting hospital infections if they're already reporting them to the Center for Medicare Medicaid Services. There might be some logic in the first. I don't understand what the logic is in the second. If they're reporting them, it should be easy to report. But it will be interesting to hear testimony on that.
Thank you. Well, what I'd like to do is have a line-by-line explanation of the... Because my understanding is we're pretty much replacing what's in this bill.
Sort of. Yeah, it's a gut and stuff at the heart of it. But
the heart of it. Could we...
Perhaps Gwen Dayton could join us.
Would that be your preference, have Gwen go through the...
I think I'd be happy to go through it, but either way.
That would be great. Thank you, Gwen. So we're going to do a review here of the Dash 3 amendments. And then... Then in light of the dash threes, we'll have a discussion about the ones and twos. Okay? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Kotek and members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I'm glad to walk through these amendments. And I will apologize in advance. We have just a couple minutes to look at these. So then these are different, in fact, than the version that we submitted to Legislative Council. But I can tell you that in bulk, of course, these are a replacement for the original bill. What does remain that is significant is in the Dash 3 amendments, we kept the existing definitions for our healthcare facility, who is covered under the bill, essentially, and for the definition of healthcare acquired infection, which... the Hospital Association felt was ably done and didn't need to be changed. Then what we did after that, then the rest of it is in large part new. There is a Section 1 added that is a legislative finding section, and as actually someone who used to work in Legislative Council, I know that they abhor legislative findings because they don't have the effect of law. But in fact, a number of us, and I spoke with others who were interested in this bill as well, felt that it was important to make a statement in this bill that in Oregon we find healthcare-acquired infections to be unacceptable. So that's why that legislative finding is there, to set the tone and set the theme for what we want to try to accomplish in Oregon. The language in line 8 of the Dash 3 amendments about trustworthy, effective, transparent, reliable, those are directly out of the consensus statement that was developed by the Patient Safety Commission's advisory committee on which I sat. Then, after the original bill was then put in the definitions, we move on to the real guts of this. Section 3 of the amendments establishes in the Office for Health Policy and Research, which is different than the original bill. The original bill had it in the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Healthcare Acquired Infection Reporting Program. And then it goes on to say the program shall... it sets out some basic goal statements, provide useful and credible information... infection information to consumers, promote quality information or improvement, in healthcare facilities, and utilize existing quality improvement efforts as much as possible. That language also is right out of the consensus statement that was developed by the Patient Safety Commission's advisory committee. And it lays out we want to give good information to consumers. We want to give good information back to healthcare facilities to help them do a better job at what they do. And we also want to build on existing efforts. The Long-Term Care Association's amendments allude to that healthcare facilities already are reporting to a number of different entities in the area of quality, and we want to build on those efforts rather than try to establish yet another reporting mechanism. Then the it allows the Office for Health Policy and Research to adopt the guts of the program by rule. That's what's really different from 2524. As you may recall, when I was here a couple of weeks ago, our real concern about the bill was not the establishment of a mandatory reporting system. Our concern with the bill is that it was very limiting and very rigid, and that it laid out in the bill what we had to report. It didn't really allow for any differentiation between large and small facilities. The two-doctor ambulatory surgery center versus Providence St. Vincent, it would be reporting exactly the same things. We didn't think that was appropriate, and we also wanted the ability to change over time as the literature gave us more information about what was really effective. So by doing this by rule, it gives us much more malleability and flexibility in the program. The rule shall require healthcare facilities to report healthcare acquired infection information as the way it's written to the office. So it continues the mandatory nature of the program. I would suggest that the word information in line 22 be changed to measures, because I don't think we're talking about information, we're talking about measures.
No, I'm not sure that's true.
Really? Is that okay? That was my, when I looked at this
in the
line.
Cases.
So.
I'm sorry.
No,
that's
all right.
What's that? Us guys just talking? Was
okay.
That on the line today?
We're doing a lot of this.
Excuse me.
Please continue. That's okay.
The rule also would specify the healthcare acquired infection information that facilities must report, prescribe the form, manner, and frequency of those reports, utilize a credible and reliable risk adjustment methodology in analyzing the infection information. I might also suggest here that language be added to the extent practical and appropriate. In the language we drafted, we put that language in as well as should, because first, if in fact healthcare facilities are reporting what we call process measures, measures within the hospital that are designed to provide good quality care. Aspirin within a certain time after admission will be an example, or taking a culture at the time somebody is admitted. Those are if you did those things, that promotes quality care. And a lot of quality assessment programs will look at those measures and how often you did them. We think those should be included. Those aren't really subject to risk adjustment. And so I would perhaps suggest some qualifying language in there that doesn't require risk adjustment when it may not actually apply, and also to acknowledge that in certain circumstances it might you might not find a risk adjustment methodology that is credible and reliable, and we don't want that to basically stop the program in its tracks. Then it goes on to say that the Office for Health Policy and Research shall provide information and advice to healthcare facilities in a manner that promotes quality improvement in healthcare facilities. That's important for the healthcare facilities, that we, when we do this, we not only give information to consumers, but we really help ourselves to do better work, because that is, from our perspective, the end goal, going back to the legislative findings. We don't want healthcare-acquired infections in Oregon. The office also can prescribe by rule the form, manner, and frequency for disclosing healthcare-acquired infection information to the public and back to healthcare facilities. There's also a section that reports in NAMA in line 15. Reports submitted to the office by healthcare facilities may not be disclosed to subpoena or used by any state agency for purposes of enforcement or regulatory action. Puts a wall. So if a facility reports an infection or infections, that information is not used over in the licensing agency to perhaps take some enforcement action against them. This is just how the patient safety reporting program is written. There are similar firewalls that are put in place so that, frankly, we get good reporting. You don't want somebody chilled in their reporting if they think that, oh, my gosh, this is going to be used against me. That's why that's there. Then, this is from the Hospital Association's perspective, this is one of the key components of the amendments. We established an advisory committee to advise the Office for Health Policy and Research in this. One of my criticisms when I was here last about 25-24 was that we really need a group of very smart people to be looking at what measures ought to be reported and how. And this amendment creates that advisory committee. 15 people on it. It's designed to have a good mix of providers and consumers. You'll notice there's not only there are physicians on it, there are hospital people on it, there are long-term care people on it, there's a state epidemiologist on it, a representative of the Patient Safety Commission is on it, a consumer rep and a labor representative, purchasers, business representatives. It's meant to be very, very broad, but also comprised of people who really know their stuff and can make decisions. The administrator and the advisory committee are charged with evaluating on a regular basis the quality and accuracy of the data that's collected and reported under this program. I'm skimming over things like their terms are 2 years. I presume that's not something of significance to you today. Then on, we're on page 3 on line 21. The advisory committee is charged with making recommendations to the Office for Health Policy and Research. And it talks about making recommendations on the evaluation and reporting of healthcare facility procedures designed to ensure quality and to reduce healthcare acquired infections. That's meant to get at those process measures. What measures that ensure quality and reduce infections do we want to be looking at? Also looking at healthcare acquired infection information or measures that align with other data collection and reporting methodologies. That gets to all the work that hospitals, for example, are doing with CMS. I know long-term care does a lot of work with CMS. We do a lot of work with the 5 Million Lives campaign, which we talked about last time, which has us reporting process measures designed to reduce infection, among other things. How can we build on that rather than try to construct yet another animal? Requiring different measures or reportable information from differently situated entities, large and small. A method for a healthcare facility that treats someone who comes into the facility with an incubating infection to notify that earlier facility where they might have been, they were treated, that in fact they probably have a reportable infection. That's what line 3 of page 4 is getting to. Somebody comes into a hospital with an already existing infection and they may have been discharged from an ambulatory surgery center 2 days before. It's very likely that the infection was acquired at the ASC. So the ASC would never know because the person's gone. But it's not reportable by the hospital because it wasn't acquired there. So that would be, there'd be no report. We're thinking that, under my example, the hospital would notify the ASC that there was an infection very likely and there should be a report. Line 7 talks about establishing a process for evaluating information and for modifications in the reporting requirements over time as appropriate. We also talk about establishing a timetable to phase in the reporting and public disclosure of healthcare-acquired infection information. The Patient Safety Commission Advisory Group felt that was important to allow some time period for initial reporting till facilities are comfortable with what they're reporting, that it's actual meaningful information. Then you can start thinking about how you want to disclose that information rather than having day two is when you start disclosing information that nobody really feels has kind of gelled yet or they're very comfortable with. The amendments establish some time frames. They are similar to the time frames in the original bill. The program shall be developed and adopted by rule no later than July 1 of 2008, and facilities shall begin reporting no later than January of 2009. It's fairly ambitious, actually, when you think about appointing this advisory committee and getting them going, that we'd have the actual program established in a year. But those time frames are in there, so we're accountable. The advisory committee will do its work and we'll get going. Then it's in large part housekeeping sort of information. The administrator of the Office for Health Policy and Research shall submit an annual report. There is the opportunity to impose a civil penalty on a healthcare facility that does not adequately participate in the program. And lastly, there is an emergency clause placed on this. That was actually at our suggestion, not because we are trying to eliminate the program by any means, but whenever you start something new, we feel it's important to have a date certain while you'll stop and assess. Is this working? Is this doing something that we really want to be doing in Oregon? Should we continue with it? So that's why there's a sunset. It's fairly extended sunset into 2017. Those are the guts of the amendments. The purpose of them is really to address the concerns we had last time about flexibility and implementation of an infection reporting program.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony and going through line by line. I realize that maybe if I'd had time to read them, I know how they came back really quickly, I wouldn't need to ask this question. But one of the things that I really liked about the original bill was the availability in Section 4 of the annual report that specified facility by facility the results of this of this information so that consumers can know in a risk-adjusted kind of way what the infection rate is at the hospital or healthcare facility at which they're seeking care. I don't see something similar to that in these amendments, and I'm wondering where that is, if that's intentionally left out, because to me that seems to be the gut of what I believe to be the intent of the bill, was to provide healthcare facility specific information to consumers.
Absolutely.
In a risk-adjusted way.
Yeah, absolutely. Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, look at Section 6 on page 4. And I apologize, because I did kind of skim over that section, and I probably skimmed over the most important part for you, so I'm sorry about that. In addition to any other report required, the administrator of the Office for Health Policy and Research shall prepare an annual report summarizing the healthcare facility report submitted. This really mirrors, as mentioned, mirror the language in the original bill. It was our intent in putting this together that we not change that provision.
Follow up. I think, and when you were reading, I actually went back and read this, and I guess I missed the words "in addition to." So I want to make sure that with these amendments, it would still be facility specific on all of these types of infections, so that I could go and say Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis has this rate of infections for this number of things, and that would be specifically disclosed relative to that facility, with that risk adjustment information there, if these amendments were...
Right. Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, I hear that, and that is certainly the intent of this bill. It is not laid out as specifically in this section as I hear that you would like. This does mirror, as I recall, the original bill. There also is language in here that talks about public disclosure of facility reports. So if you wanted to see what a particular hospital's rates were, you could also access that facility's report. But what I think I'm hearing you saying is you'd rather have something in that provision about the annual report that lays it out hospital by hospital, because I don't recall that the original bill necessarily did that, but I don't have that in front of me right now.
May I follow up? Mm-hmm. Actually, in the original bill, in Section 4, Sub 4, says the annual report shall, for each individual health care facility in this state, compare the risk-adjusted health care facility acquired infection rates collected under Section 2 of this Act. The department, in consultation with the advisory committee, shall make the comparison as easy to comprehend as possible. So it was, to me that language was very precise and clear in terms of what a consumer would be able to access, to understand, and I'm not seeing that in the amendments.
You're right, and I haven't had a chance to compare that provision to this provision, and this provision is different. It's meant to mirror the provision in the original bill. To the extent that we have an opportunity to revisit some of the language in the amendments, we can certainly consider that.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up a little bit on what Representative Gell just said, and I absolutely agree. I'd like to go back to your subsection 6 on page 2, please. The statement that reports submitted to the office by healthcare facilities pursuant to this section may not be disclosed to, subject to subpoena, or used by any state agency for purpose of any enforcement or regulation, regulatory action in relation to a participating healthcare facility. I understand fully why you would use something like that in a program that was both voluntary and confidential as the Patient Safety Commission. And that's why the language is, and we're saying it's voluntary. It's intended to be confidential. It's not intended to be reported by specific institutions. In a system where we're talking about both required reporting, mandatory reporting, and public disclosure, you need to help me just to understand how, if they don't report properly, it gets chilled, the penalty of law will help them along, I assume.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, a distinction I need to make in your earlier comment about voluntary is that with the Patient Safety Reporting Program, participation is indeed voluntary. A hospital can choose to participate or not, but once they participate, they have to report all their adverse events. So once they're in, there is no real voluntariness about whether I'm going to report this adverse event today or not this one tomorrow.
So you think there were only 18 in the whole state last year, right?
I'm not going to defend that number, and I have no basis to. So in a sense, the reporting aspect of it is really quite
quite similar. And our concern is we want, if we're going to have a good program and really are going to try to reduce infections in the state, which is everyone's goal, we need to have full and rich reporting. And if this is really reporting is an arm of the regulatory agency, I think that you're going to find that it's difficult for those who are asked to participate to do so fully because they will be penalized for doing it. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
Can I follow up on
that? You may.
So Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis has 2,000 hospital-acquired infections and some other hospital, Sacred Heart in Eugene, has 80. And the office reports that. And now we have a report. The report says Samaritan had 2,000 hospital infections. So a regulatory agency calls up the office and says, you have a public report that says this agency, this particular hospital has 2,000 acquired infections. We want to go find out what's going on. And under this, they would say, well, yes, we've made it public, but we can't give it to you. Or you can't subpoena this report we've just made public. I don't understand that.
Well, Chair Kotick, Representative Greenlick, perhaps the distinction is not so much that whether the regulatory agency can see it or not, but they can't use it to assess an independent separate a fine against the hospital because they may have violated some provision of their licensing requirements. That's,
even though it's public.
Yes. Because that's not the point. That's not the point of this program. The point of this program is to provide consumers with good information, and at least in the estimation of the hospitals, the point of the program is to provide consumers good information, hospitals good information to improve quality. And so we don't see that regulatory component is contributing to either one of those goals.
May I follow up again? Your language is that the report of this, the purpose of this is that the legislative assembly finds that Oregon should be free from infections acquired during the delivery of health care. That's the point of it. And if it takes regulatory action to achieve that, that's, I would certainly argue perfectly appropriate if that's what it takes. That's the point, isn't it? I mean, that's your language, I think, right?
Absolutely. That is our language, absolutely. But we don't believe that it's best done through a regulatory approach. We believe it's best done through the reporting and then the quality improvement that arises from that.
Representative Bondich. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'd like to look at page 1, line 22. I can understand the need for flexibility, and you were talking about how through rulemaking you'll get some more flexibility, but I liked the specificity that was in the original bill, particularly as it relates to, for example, the most common infections, and at least have some guidance to make sure that it's rates and not just measures that are being reported. So I guess I want to urge more specificity than just acquired infection information, because even though there's rulemaking provided, I don't think that gets at what we intended to get at with the original bill.
Yeah, and Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, that was to some degree my point with perhaps inserting measures instead of information, so that we make it clear that we are talking about actual measures, not just information about hospital-acquired infections. I think where your specificity might need to come in would be in the recommendations of the advisory committee, where we talk about including process measures in addition to other measures. That's on page 3. So that we give the advisory committee some guidance as to where they need to head. Am I addressing your thought?
In part, but I think that the concern is more that we're looking follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. The protocol sometimes is awkward. I think we're looking for rates, not measures. And everybody correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think just the measures is sufficient.
Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici.
Pardon me?
A rate is a measure.
Well, we are, I think, defining what the measures
right
are.
Yes,
exactly. Right. I think when we think measures, we think, well, what is the rate of this or what is the rate of that? So I think it is a way to talk about rates. But I think I'm hearing your concern that you really want to know what is the rate of whatever measure is chosen by the advisory committee in a hospital, ambulatory surgery center, long-term care, or wherever. Is that what you're saying? I
I believe so. I think that's what I'm saying.
I think thank you. And I would
more
agree.
Specificity.
We need some more specificity, you know, for the intent of the rulemaking. I think we should make that clear. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is along the same line. I can understand the desire to have flexibility of doing some of these things by rule, and I think in many ways that can help serve consumers better by not having to come back to statute to be able to address certain kinds of infections. That said, it seemed like Section 2 of the original bill did provide some of that specificity. While it laid out some specific infections that I think consumers are very interested in, and which I believe we heard from the current voluntary program that they're tracking, the surgical site infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, central line-related bloodstream infections, urinary tract infections, that those would be very central to what we want to know, but item E was other types of infections determined by the department by rule. So it seems like already in that original bill that rulemaking flexibility is there, and that by having some of these basic pieces in statute, the Legislative Assembly can provide guidance to the department and to this task force in determining the types of infections that we're trying to get at. Would you be comfortable with some specificity in statute as to specific these types of specific infection measures?
And Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, we are very comfortable with talking about some additional specificity. We are less comfortable with the particular list that is here. For example, you heard testimony last time from the state epidemiologist that ventilator-associated pneumonia is very difficult to define. It's very difficult to among different. I'm not going to state it as well as he did. Among different hospitals, there's different definitions of what that is. That's not the greatest measure. The problem with that list is we have to measure those, and we have to measure them in every single ambulatory surgery center. We have to measure them in every single hospital, regardless of size, regardless of whether a hospital isn't critical access that doesn't have surgical site issues. Particularly, that's the measure for them because it's listed here. And what we want to see is a greater ability to pick the appropriate measures or rates that seem to make sense in Oregon. Now, maybe the advisory committee will say, yeah, we want to do central line-related bloodstream infection because that makes good sense for Oregon. I don't think we would argue with that. But whether we want to do ventilator-associated pneumonia, maybe not. It might cause more confusion than it's worth. Surgical site infection, yeah, in some hospitals, maybe not in all, for example. So I certainly hear the need for greater specificity so you don't end up with a program that doesn't measure anything you care about. And I do very much hear that. But I think this, while it does have the E, other types of infectious determinant, it requires that we do A through D. And that's where we're not so sure that's the right public policy for Oregon.
I appreciate that response, and maybe that's something that can be worked on moving forward. I'm uncomfortable putting everything in rule because it seems to gut any teeth out of the measure itself if there isn't specificity. And it seems like if there's a hospital that doesn't provide that type of service, it would be easy to report because there wouldn't be any to report. And I guess the last part that I would just make is a comment. One of the other issues that I have some discomfort with in terms of developing this by rule is that it's proposed in these amendments. It's a 15-member, committee, and of those 15 members, only one would be representing the interests of a consumer. And given that this is a bill that's supposed to be helping consumers access information, I would like to see a better voice for the consumer there so that there could be some more equal representation at that table to get at these kinds of things, especially if we were to move forward in diluting the bill with so much less specificity and teeth.
Madam Chair, the state epidemiologist is here.
I know that. We might have him come up here. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenlit, for pointing out. I have notes that the state epidemiologist is here because I have notes on testimony from Dr. Suslak from our last hearing, as well as notes from Ms. Dayton in regard to need to align the processes in order to address the outcomes. And Dr. Suslak said need to address, to add process measures, delete the outcome measures in the bill as it is. And I think that having those types of observations and comments from the professionals in the field wouldn't necessarily override the concerns that I'm hearing would, or obviate them, make them not part of what you're trying to accomplish if it's accomplished under the guidance of the professional community. And in regard to the list of people that would comprise the advisory board, I think I agree with the comment that there is only one consumer representative, yet you have all of these people responsible that we're trying to make this apply to. So it's that whole community that's responsible for bringing this into being. So I'm not sure we're that far apart in the ultimate goal here.
Thank you. I'm going to, like, went off the hook here for a bit, because we're going to have to keep working on this.
Yes.
But I appreciate you going through all the details of the amendment. We're going to have to go back to the table. But I wanted to give some time for a few more folks to talk. So thank
Absolutely.
You.
Thank you very much.
If we could have briefly, Lauren Rhodes, briefly talk about the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. And David Schlachtis, would you come up also? A few folks who fall that are not hospitals, but would fall necessarily under this, I assume. So, Lauren, you want to start?
Yes, Chair Kotek, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. And as far as the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, are as per my original testimony a few weeks back, we had indicated that under CMS regulations, nursing facilities are currently reporting 13 infection-related reports, one of which is the urinary tract infection data that was originally included in Hospital 2524. And what we were interested in achieving through the Dash 1 or the Dash 2 amendments, whichever the committee preferred, is an attempt to not necessarily exempt facilities that are currently reporting to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but actually, instead of requiring duplicative reporting, asking the Department of Human Services to collect the data that's already submitted to them and then goes on to CMS and to deliver that information to whichever entity is created, whether it be an advisory committee through the Office of Health Policy and Research or through DHS or however that gets created. That was our intent. And the Dash 1s were originally removing long-term care facilities for the purpose that they already are submitting that data, but the alternative was to actually just direct DHS to resubmit the information to the newly created entity. And in that vein, I did briefly review the Dash 3s, and we're comfortable with the concepts. I think one, my only request or input would be to where the references to requiring healthcare facilities to report the data to the office, again, sends language that if facilities are already reporting the data that the newly formed committee determines is necessary and relevant to collect that data from the existing resources.
Quick question then. So it's just that you don't want to have to redo all what you're already reporting, but how would you feel about additional reporting on top of what you might already be reporting? And I'm not saying there is anything, because you're reporting a lot to CMS. I'm just wondering.
Chair Kotek, you're exactly right. We'd like to avoid sending the same report twice. So if there's a streamlining attempt at that, we'd like to see that happen. Additional reporting, I mean, I couldn't speak to that now. I guess I'd like to see what other, you know, if there are other measures out there or other data that the state needs, then, you know, we're happy to comply with whatever additional reporting would be necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions? Is it Schlachtis?
Yeah. Chair Kotek, committee members, my name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Willamette Orthopedic Group. Willamette Surgery Center is a Medicare-licensed ambulatory surgery center. We're actually two blocks away at 14th and State. We have four operating rooms. We have one treatment room. We do 3,000 surgeries a year. We are licensed, or accredited, I should say, by JCO. We have the exact same accreditation requirements that hospitals have. And, in fact, many surgery centers throughout this state have the exact same accreditation standards that hospitals have. We follow the same guidelines and the same rules that they have with regard to accreditation, infection control, and things like that. We obviously have not had a chance to see the amendments until 5 minutes ago as well, and so What obviously we would like is the opportunity to come back at some other point and give a more detailed response, but I can give you some comments and some concerns that we have right now. And before I do that, the first thing I'd like to say is I truly would like to invite all of you to come see our surgery center, to see if you've never really been in an ambulatory surgery center, if you don't really have a complete sense of what the surgery centers do, please come see us. We're two blocks away. You can come during lunch. And you'll get a very good idea as to how we take care of our patients, how we treat our patients, what we do to make sure that our infection rates are as low as they possibly can be. Having said that, some of the concerns that we have with the bill as it's stated right now, one is how to identify the source of the infection. Ms. Dayton made a comment that, frankly, I think was inappropriate. You know, she made the comment that if the patient goes to an ASC and 2 days later they end up in the hospital, well, it was pretty likely that it came from the ASC. I don't think that's fair and defendable. I don't think she can defend that. You have no idea whether or not the patient came in and they were prone to infections or they had a developing infection. We have no idea whether or not the patient took care of their wound properly when they were sent home. Patients are in surgery centers for 3 hours. They're in and out of our surgery center in 3 hours. We can't monitor whether or not they follow the instructions. We give them very detailed discharge instructions, but we can't monitor whether or not they follow those discharge instructions and take care of their wound properly. We don't know what their homes are like. We don't know whether or not they could have acquired something while they were home for a couple of days. There are patients that go home that really don't have they don't have a lot of caregivers, and so they're doing things on their own. So I think it's not appropriate to make the assumption that that infection that they came into the hospital with started in the surgery center 2 days earlier. And so I think we have real concerns with being able to properly identify the source of the infection. A second concern that we have is that whole phrase risk-adjusted. You know, that we want to provide consumers with some type of risk-adjusted information on infection rates. Obviously, the devil's in the details. And I think it's really difficult for us to identify what should be an appropriate infection rate. So let's take a look at a carpal tunnel. To do a carpal tunnel surgery typically takes 15 to 20 minutes of operating room time, patients in and out. So does a surgery center, which historically has had far lower infection rates than hospitals, documented through CMS and everyone else, because we've had far lower infection rates, would our risk-adjusted rate be close to zero? But because hospitals have more nosocomial infections, more infections on a regular basis, would they have a higher rate? And so if their expected rate might be 2% and they're at 1.5%, they're good. And if our expected rate is at 0.25% and we're at 0.3%, we're bad. I think we've got some real concerns with how we're going to identify what risk-adjusted means and then report that information. I have some concerns with providing that information to the public only in the sense, not that they shouldn't be provided that information, but what are they going to do with that? Throughout this entire state, there's lots of communities where there's one hospital. So if you find out that your hospital, and you're a one-hospital town, your hospital has a higher infection rate than you want, personally, are most patients going to drive 2.5 hours to a different town to get their carpal tunnel taken care of? The reality is, I don't know that they're going to do that. I think it's one thing to think that, okay, in Portland, I have more choices because there's lots of hospitals. But I'm still, by and large, limited to the hospitals that are associated with my health plan. If I happen to have a health plan that goes to the legacy hospitals and they have a higher infection rate than the Providence hospitals, I'm probably not going to want to pay an extra $500 copay to be out of network to go to a hospital that has an infection rate that's 2 or 3% lower.
Mr. Schlachtis, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm really glad you're here today because we didn't hear from the surgery centers when we had the first public hearing. But we have other things we have to do today.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering if you just want to wrap it up, and then if you would be interested in being in contact for the surgery centers as we go forward with this,
I would be happy to, and okay. I guess to wrap it up, I would say that our surgery centers are committed to keeping the infection rates as low as humanly possible, zero if we can achieve that. I'm not so sure this bill helps us achieve zero or as low as humanly possible infection rates, and we'd love to talk more about it. If our goal is to get lower infection rates, then there might be a different way to achieve it than this bill.
Can I ask a brief question?
Yes, and thank you for being here.
How do you know what your infection rate is?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, the only way for us to realistically know what our infection rate is if we get information reported back from the physician who actually performed the surgery. So you see an orthopedic surgeon, he does a surgery at our surgery center, then you go back to the orthopedic surgeon for follow-up care. He knows, yeah, I'm sure that was something that I did or that we did at the surgery center that caused it. So, but it is very, very difficult for us to know exactly.
At that regular?
We do, because our surgeons are in our surgery center regularly. We have a quality assurance program. We survey our physicians on a regular basis for follow-up, and we check with our patients on a follow-up basis.
And what was your rate last year?
I don't know it off the top of my head. It was either 1% or 2%. It was very low.
You're welcome. And thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we have your card, so we're still working this. So, but it's good. Both your facilities are included in this as we speak, so speak up and make sure that this, you know, makes some sense for the different facilities outside
of
the hospital. So
thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
I know we had the folks from the Patient Safety Commission and Uber and the state epidemiologist here, but in the interest of time, unless you have a pressing comment about the dash threes. Yes, no? Jim? Yes, you may.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jim Dameron. And very briefly, I just wanted to say that the Patient Safety Commission is in general supportive of the amendments. We think that flexibility is useful in the measures. We like the clarification of the goals, so we know exactly what this reporting program is meant to achieve, and I like the accountability around specific dates. The consensus group that the commission put together really emphasized that public reporting by facility was an important thing to do, so that I don't want to ever lose sight of that, and that rates needed to be reported. There was some controversy about which ones, but rates, outcome measures with rates, facility-specific, were important. The redrafted dash three amendments talk about really two goals: that it's public reporting by facility, and that there's quality improvement activity at the facility level. So I'm asking you to consider whether there's a role for the Patient Safety Commission in that second function. Representative Greenlick mentioned that he had talked with the commission about its possible role in this reporting program. We honestly struggled with, we have a voluntary and confidential program. How would that fit with a public and a public one and a mandatory one? We couldn't see it fitting across the board. It would be difficult for us to talk to hospitals about holding some information confidential and reporting others publicly. We haven't abandoned. We believe in the voluntary approach for certain kinds of things, but we believe that we are in a position to help ground and make real the second goal of using the information created from this program to help drive change at the facility level, rapid cycle reporting, convening best practice groups, keeping an eye on that second goal. So we ask you to at least consider explicitly mentioning the Patient Safety Commission in the bill. Here, you need to work on this part. Okay?
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Dameron. I do note that your penultimate paragraph there, you mentioned, of course, we believe that such a role should be funded. So have you assigned such always picking up on those little details?
Yes, right. No, I have not. I don't know. I haven't seen the, you know, if we're talking maybe about a halftime FTE, perhaps. Depends on how it was crafted, but something on that magnitude. I believe it needs to be real. I need to believe it needs to be funded. People might argue that it should be something the advisory group does, but I think that the advisory group is just that, an advisory group, not necessarily a do follow through assignment sort of group. And to that extent, I believe the Patient Safety Commission should be on the advisory group. We're critical to this. Ultimately, healthcare acquired infections, I believe, is a patient safety issue. These are things that we believe we can eliminate. They're fundamental to the management of the care, and that's a patient safety issue. So, an order of magnitude, half an FTE, perhaps dedicated to that function inside the Patient Safety Commission. That's my pitch, as it were.
Thank you, Jim. And you know, and if we go ahead with the structure advised in the dash threes, we might have to look at funding for the Office of Health Policy and Research as well. So, thank you.
I'm sure they'll have no physical.
They'll have no physical, right? Thank you for being here. I think it's always important when we're looking at legislation to remember why we're doing this. So, we have a consumer here today from Hood River, and I'd like to call her up. Is it Deandra?
Yes, Deandra Valier.
Thank you. You could welcome, introduce yourself for the record, and. And if you could keep it relatively brief, because we want to hear another one.
You don't want to get me started.
and I'm guessing you probably have some personal stories, so if you need to brief that.
I have two personal stories. My father passed away from a hospital-acquired infection, which was not with
me. Introduce yourself and where you're from, please.
Deandra Valier from Hood River.
Thank you.
And also my husband acquired an infection while he was at a hospital stay here in Portland. The stay should have been 4 days, 8 at the max. He was there for 8 weeks due to the infections he acquired. When they discharged him with an open spine from the infection he acquired. I've been very active in getting infection reporting done. I was assigned as a consumer on the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. I do believe they have a very good goal at the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, but I don't believe that this is the place. This is a consumer bill, and I think consumers need to know when they go to a hospital, what the infection rate is. And yes, my experience, I would drive to another state if I had to. The good news is there are some hospitals that are doing very well reporting, handling their infection control. You can go to some hospitals that have a zero bloodstream infection rate, another hospital which might have a 10. And these rates are all clearly defined by the CDC. They've been reported voluntarily to the CDC. The CDC knows the extreme difference. Dr. Haley, who started the reporting at the CDC, now believes the public should know because a lot of hospitals aren't stepping up to reducing the infection rates.
Thank you for being here today. I appreciate you coming to talk about this bill. Hold on. Any questions?
Yeah, I do.
Representative Green?
Do you have any information on that CDC?
I do. I certainly do. I have right here an infection rate that that's their last report, which was 2004. The new one hasn't come out yet. But when you look at this, it's totally astounding. You can see, and they do apples to apples. They do the four types of infection, which are 80% of all the hospital-acquired infections are the central line, the VAP, the UTI, and the surgical site. That's why they CDC collects these. They don't mucky it up with all any other insignificant. But you can see when they report it, they do the type of hospitals compared to the type of hospitals. That's a very clear, easy way for a consumer to understand these infection rates. And you can see, if you look at this, you can go to pediatric. The best 10 percentile on a ventilator-associated pneumonia rate is zero. The worst 10 percentile is 8. So you have 8 times more likely chance that you're going to get the VAP at the hospital who is not monitoring their infection control. And there are some other examples that are even more shocking than that. That's just one I picked out of here. And I think it's really important that a consumer knows. And not only that, I think when I talked to the CDC, they told me that These hospitals have been reporting, but very rarely do they go back and see what percentile they're in. They can get that information, how to calculate that from the CDC, but very rarely hospitals even go back and look. So no, they really don't know what their rates are. And making this public has made, in the 16 other states that are reporting them, has made hospitals look at their rates and say, gee, we didn't know we were in the worst 10th percentile. We need to do something.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you being a patient advocate. I hope your husband is doing well. And we did receive a letter, and I just want to read one of your lines from your letter, if you don't mind. When we have more information available about an automobile or toaster that we purchase than we do about the hospital we decide to be admitted to, something is seriously wrong. So I really appreciate you being here.
And just one other quick comment. I know that everyone feels that JCO, the accreditation agency, is taking care of this problem. They haven't. I've gone to JCO, and the bottom line is they will come to a hospital. They will survey you. They will tell you where you are in perspective to the other hospitals. It's then up to the hospital themselves to bring themselves up to the standard that's expected. JCO does not even look at infection rates. They say as long as you're trying, that's fine with us. Well, you can see a lot of hospitals aren't trying as hard as they should.
Thank you.
I just have a quick question.
Representative Bonnie.
Before you leave, could you tell me again the four most common types of infections?
Surgical site. Then I think it's the four that's listed in the original bill.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yes, it is.
The CDC. Okay.
Yes. And I can get all of this information to you. I can get you also, the definitions are very clear from the CDC, how to identify each particular infection.
That'd be
and
great.
Most of the hospitals are actually already reporting to the CDC. So the section that describes this in the first part of the original bill is clean cut and dry.
Thank you. If you could meet with the committee staff afterwards, we can get that information.
Okay.
Or figure out how to connect with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we still have work to do on this bill. Representative Greenlink, are you willing to meet with the partners again? And what I'd like to do is work session this next week after you've had a chance to review the amendments, go back and look at them, talk to a few of the folks.
I'm hearing is that the committee wants to make sure that there's specificity. There's enough specificity in the wording to make sure things don't get lost. And that I have a problem with that section six. What else should we be working on?
Sandy was taking copious notes.
Okay.
But I think you're right, the specificity issue is, especially if we send it to rulemaking, or the bulk of it.
Well,
if that is the intent.
My assumption is the rulemaking process in this case, it would be a DAS rulemaking process, since the office is a DAS office.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't really relate to the committee, but yes.
Thank you. Thank you for taking this on, and we'll see everyone back next week, I think. Close the work session then on 25-24 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3017. Sandy, what's this about?
This bill, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 3017, comes at the request of Representative Crummell, chief sponsor, and yourself.
That's right.
This requires the Board of Dentistry to adopt rules implementing a certification program for certain counselors and health assistants to apply fluoride varnishes to teeth of preschool-aged children. No revenue impact at this time, and I have no fiscal information.
Thank you. And, indeed, I am one of the co-sponsors, and I always think it's easier for the person who brought the idea sometimes to explain everything. So, Dr. Love, would you come up, please? And thank you for waiting while we.
Oh no, it's so.
A little breather
it's so
there.
Complicated.
On.
This is way less complicated, so it's easier.
It's a good way to roll down. For the
I feel like I should use a lot of big words, though, just to make it seem more complicated. Chairman Kotek and members of the committee, I'm coming here to support House Bill 3017.
Oh,
yes.
Your name again.
Oh, I'm sorry, April Love, dentist.
Thank you.
And since this is essentially a discussion on the disease of tooth decay, that's where I'd like to start. Tooth decay is caused by a bacteria that lives in the mouth, and when sugar is eaten, within seconds this bacteria starts to make acid from the sugar. When acid comes in contact with the tooth, it dissolves out the minerals, the calcium and the phosphate. It takes about 30 minutes for the saliva to neutralize the acid, and then the minerals actually go back into the tooth. So if you're going to get a cavity or not, it's over time, more minerals have come out of the tooth than go back in. So if you don't want cavities, you either need to decrease the number of decay-causing bacteria, or you make the teeth more resistant to acid. Having a dentist fill the holes does not change the disease process. All it does is keep the holes from getting bigger, hopefully. And unfortunately, brushing and flossing really doesn't make much of a difference either unless you're using fluoride toothpaste. And back in the 60s, when I was a dental hygienist, the average age of, actually back in the 60s, we did, it was really before fluoride was really recognized as being a real benefit. And so the only thing we could do to help people not get cavities is they had to go on an incredibly rigorous no-sugar diet. And since the average age of, the average person over 65 only had 8 teeth, it really didn't work very well. And then now it's, you know, 40 years later, and now the average person over 65 has 24 teeth. And it isn't because people are eating less sugar. There's been a 20% increase in the amount of sugar that we eat. Even though taking care of gum disease is part of this improvement, basically it's from the use of fluoride. Fluoride in water has been widespread throughout the country. Fluoride toothpaste, fluoride treatments in a dental office, fluoride and fluoride varnish. Fluoride does two things. One thing it does is that it holds the calcium and the phosphate in the teeth in a tighter chemical bond, so it's harder for the acid to leach it out. The other thing it does is that the only reason bacteria make acid from sugar is that that whole process is what gives them energy, and the energy helps them survive. Fluoride can actually interfere in that metabolic process so that the bacteria will die. So it does the two things we need to do. It strengthens the teeth, and it kills the bacteria. This is something that I known, and so in the 40 years or the 25 years that I was practicing as a dentist, we addressed those issues. And when I retired, I pretty much thought we had solved the tooth decay problem, and then I ended up in Head Start again. And then I realized that the problem was way bigger than I'd ever had thought. Kids in Head Start are high risk of tooth decay because of their poverty status. That's almost a automatic. When someone is poor, they are very high risk for getting cavities. Their parents tend to have poor oral health. That's where the bacteria comes from initially, you get the bacteria that causes decay from your parents. And then what I've found, because I do a lot of education with the parents, is that they lack the information about how the decay process works. And then even when they find out, then they have a problem with the follow-through on tooth decay prevention. And because we have so little water fluoridation in the state, our Head Start kids are really at a disadvantage. When I screen the kids, and I have some of my data in here, 60 to 70% of my little 3- and 4-year-olds already have cavities. The national average for this age is about 29-30. So we just are having, and then I have a couple of areas of data here where we've been able to compare isolated fluoridated areas and non-fluoridated areas, and the kids in fluoridated areas in the Head Start programs have half the cavities. And the biggest thing, though, is that their decay isn't so progressive that they've had to go to the hospital and have their dental work under general anesthesia. So in the absence of this benefit, we just need to use every other way that we can think of to prevent tooth decay. And because I worked with Head Start programs, because most of our Head Start kids also qualify for the WIC program, they actually are seeing a lot of potential care providers. The WIC counselors deal with nutrition and talk to their clients about tooth decay. The Head Start health assistants spend a lot of time dealing with cavities. All the kids in Head Start have to have a dental screening. Sometimes the program requires that a dentist does the screening. Sometimes the programs allow dental hygienists to do the screening. But then the health assistants have to follow up and make sure the kids are getting to a dentist, getting all their fillings filled, and it's incredibly time-consuming. For kids not covered by OMAP or private insurance, they have to find a dentist who will treat the kids for free or at a vastly reduced rate. It's especially challenging because, and this is one of the reasons that I got involved in this, is because these kids have needs that are way outside the scope of a general dentist like I am. And so they're kind of We have to refer them to pediatric dentists, but there are very few pediatric dentists in Oregon because the dental school stopped their pediatric specialty program years ago. It's now reinstated, but we just have a real lack of pediatric dentists. And what I found is that my health assistants that I work with at Head Start are very, very anxious to be able to do something to prevent the disease so they don't have to spend so much time monitoring after it's occurred. Fluoride varnishes have been used in Europe for almost 30 years. And one of the reasons is they have their kids that are almost always covered through high school by public programs. And there have been many, many studies for those 30 years about the efficacy of the use of fluoride varnish. It dramatically reduces tooth decay in both the primary and the permanent teeth. It provides a very high level of fluoride for almost 24 hours because it's really, really sticky. I don't know whether any of you have had it. And you can actually try it, or you can take that out and put it on your fingernail, and you see how very, very sticky it is. It's a very, very high concentration of fluoride. What makes it safe is that it's in a varnish, so the varnish sticks it to the teeth, and then over time, the fluoride in the varnish penetrates into the tooth enamel and makes the tooth much less likely to dissolve in acid. And the kids don't mind it. It's a little annoying for adults because it's kind of sticky on your teeth, but the kids are pretty good about it. And it's very, very safe. The fluoride is in a, because it's in the varnish, that when it finally comes off the teeth and is ingested, the body totally can't use it. The blood plasma rate is about it's about what you get if you brush your teeth once with fluoride toothpaste. At this time, this is the frustration. At this time, the only people who can apply fluoride varnish are nurses, which is kind of weird because they have no training for it, dentists and dental hygienists. And when I go to my Head Start programs, I can actually make my health assistant my official dental assistant. She can put it on when I train her, but then she can only put the fluoride varnish on if I'm there. So that means to get the two or three times of application every year, I have to go back, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds of kids, and it's very it's difficult sometimes for me to continue to go back, especially when the health counsel or the health assistant is right there with the kids. So what this bill would allow, it would allow the health counselor or the health assistants at the Head Start programs and the WIC counselors with WIC to be able to apply the fluoride varnish, but only after the kids have already been screened by the appropriate people. And it would probably be likely to be the follow-up two or three times that we apply the varnish. The other thing is that they would, that I think it's very, very imperative that before they do this, that they take a class that would be designated by the State Board of Dentistry, and the class would include the decay process, how fluoride works, and just techniques of application of the fluoride varnish, because there are a lot of tricks to doing it. There are a number of very successful public health fluoride varnish programs, but they're not everywhere they're needed. Washington County doesn't have anything on any dental preventative program at all. And sometimes in some of the programs that do exist, there are problems with reimbursement from OMAP. This program that I would like to do, it has nothing to do with reimbursement. It's when there's fluoride varnish available, it would be nice if we also had people available to apply it. And it's just an alternative way to provide fluoride varnish. And actually, today I just talked to a dental hygienist who does this up in Washington, because dental hygienists are able to do the screenings and apply the varnish in the WIC and the Head Start programs. And she said that after 2 years, she's finding a dramatic decrease in the amount of cavities that they're seeing in the Head Start kids.
Thank you. Thanks, Laura. And thanks for the sample. Fun to see what things look like. Questions for Dr. Love? Yes, Representative Bonavich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Love. I have a question about something in your testimony that is baffling to me, because it's on the first page, and it's the last sentence in the second paragraph where it says, brushing and flossing doesn't make much of a difference. And I can't believe a dentist just told me that because it's so contrary to everything that I've heard from any dentist.
What's ironic is that when, Representative Bonamici, is that when I was a hygienist and then I went back to dental school and they told me that brushing and flossing didn't make any difference, I got up and I was ticked because as a hygienist I said that is absolutely wrong. The reality, statistically, most of the tooth decay occurs, especially in children. Now, if we're talking about children, most of the tooth decay occurs in the chewing surfaces of the teeth. Your toothbrush doesn't get there. And it's the biggest advantage of brushing is, as far as tooth decay is concerned, is the fluoride toothpaste itself. You can keep your teeth lickety-split clean, but if you're eating a lot of sugar, you're still going to get cavities. And I know it's really one of those statistical things. Most cavities occur in the occlusal surfaces in kids, and so statistically that's true. On the other hand, that if you're using fluoride toothpaste and you're flossing between your teeth, I believe that you can control some of your interproximal decay. From my own observation, statistics don't show that. But I kind of think it does help. But it's really the fluoride, and the flossing gets the plaque out from between the teeth, so the fluoride is better able to work. I'm sorry, because I don't want you to stop flossing.
We're not
going
to get them to tell the kids.
I know. I know. And actually, we do lie sometimes. When people won't floss for gum disease, I tell them that they have to floss for tooth decay because it's really important for them to floss so they don't get tooth decay.
Thank you. So I have a question.
Yeah.
The difference between the fluoride varnish and the dental sealant?
They're totally different. Chairman Kotek, the dental sealant is just a bis-GMA plastic. And it's just a plastic that bonds to the enamel surface of the chewing surfaces of the teeth where those deep occlusal grooves are. Basically, it's just a plastic shield that will keep the bacteria from living in those deep grooves. And fluoride varnish is just totally different. It's benefit lasts as long as it's on the teeth. The fluoride in the fluoride varnish sinks into the teeth. It actually sinks through the intact enamel surface, combines with the calcium phosphate in a tight chemical bond, and it just makes the tooth more impervious to breaking down an acid.
And a follow-up to that, so when I go to the dentist and swish around with fluoride, and I'm not supposed to do anything for an hour or something, that's kind of a smaller version of that, essentially?
I hate to tell you this, because dentists don't. It was like when I was talking about dental hygienists and dentists, is that you learn more about prevention when you're a dental hygienist. And since I've been involved in this, I know a lot more now than I did when I was in practice, which I'm a little embarrassed by. Mm-hmm. It turns out the fluoride foam isn't all that great. The fluoride gel is pretty good in a dental office, but really fluoride varnish is the best. So now I have the dilemma. I love it when I would clean someone's teeth and they go out and say, that feels so good. And then you put this fluoride varnish on, which feels like you got about a week's worth of plaque on your teeth. So I've had a really hard time actually using the fluoride varnish on my patients, but it actually works so much better. I don't have a choice. So when you do this, if you're going to use this on your own teeth, which you can, especially if you have sensitive areas, exposed roots, it's really helpful. Do it before you go to bed because it's a little annoying because you want to scrape it off your teeth.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. And I would like to kind of pursue the dental sealant contrast a little bit. Now, is it applied, folded on, like
the
retainer?
No, I wish it was easier than that. That's why, in a way, that's really why I support dental hygienists being able to assess and to apply it, because it takes time to do it. You have to really be good at isolating the teeth, because you can't have saliva. What you do is you put actually a low-grade acid on the top surface of the teeth. You rinse it out. You have to dry it absolutely thoroughly. You paint on this plastic, and then you put a light on it. They have some auto cures, but they don't work really well. You put a light on it, which sets it in 10 seconds. In the meantime, you have to keep the mouth isolated, which is easier in big kids. It's a little tougher with second and third graders, but that's where we really hit it. We want to hit those teeth as soon as they've erupted into the mouth enough so that we can apply the sealant. And that's about, they're supposed to get those teeth when they're about six. They're fully erupted about seven, so that's why we hit second and third grade, although I've heard that they're actually going to try to get to first graders, because what we're having, what we're seeing is that kids, there's a certain percentage of kids that already by second grade, those first molars are already decayed and we can't put sealants on. That's the biggest problem with sealants. You can't have cavities in those teeth unless, you can't put the sealant on if there's actually frank decay.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I suppose that's why in your prior testimony on the previous bill about the dental assistant, you're targeting the older students. I think you said second and third grade.
Second and third graders.
And this one, it's with the varnish.
I'm hitting the primary teeth, all the baby teeth, right. But it has shown to be just as good on permanent teeth. And actually where I'd really like to see it go is on our geriatric patients, because there's no reason that we can't be applying this to our geriatric patients who are trapped in their care centers and keep them from having as much rampant decay as they do.
And how long does it last?
Either one. Oh, either one. The sealants will last as long if you've done a really good job getting the sealant and have been able to apply it without getting it the surface. I see adults who had them at Multnomah County 10 years ago. They can last a very long time. However, on the other hand, if a kid goes out and chews, popcorn kernels or ice cubes, it'll fracture off. So, there has to be some care, but it tends to stay in the really deep grooves, and that's exactly where we want it, because the decay-causing bacteria has to have oxygen to survive. So essentially what we're doing is that we're sealing off those really deep grooves and fissures so that the bacteria... the reality is we are sealing bacteria inside those really deep grooves, but then we seal off the oxygen so they die.
Thank you. I wasn't meaning to derail into the whole discussion.
Oh, no. Well, I think I'm into sealants. And I say the only problem with sealant programs is that then kids get their 12-year molars in, and usually the sealant programs are for the first molars in second and third grades, and what we're hoping is that it'll expand so that we also go back in the fifth and sixth grades and get those 12-year molars, because that's what I see. I see great first molars, and then the 12-year molars are just bombed out.
Thank you, Dr. See why I like her expertise, because, there's a lot of different ways we can be dealing with these issues, and it's good to have these together today, so there's the difference between the dental sealant.
That's cool.
So any more questions for Dr. Love, because I want to take a couple more people for testimony, and then I do want to move the one bill quickly. I don't think it'll take very long, so thank you.
Well, thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bratz and Mr. Cosgrove, can you come up together, please?
Thank you, Chair Kotek. Again, I have some written testimony for you here. Again, this bill came out the same day, so I've shared it with the members of the board, but they've not had a chance to actually physically talk about it. The only question I have is that the current statutes and our current charges, we regulate and license dentists and dental hygienists. We also do regulate how dentists can use dental assistants. This is clearly a much farther expansion of talking about WIC counselors and some others, and so I'm not sure the perspective of, we're kind of getting into some other areas and issues like that. And again, I think that's what the board has to look at. There obviously would be a fiscal impact. I've not had a chance to analyze that. I don't know how many of these counselors there are, and I don't know how many of these counselors would want this type of certification. So, there are just some questions that we have, and I think we have to go through it. There may be some other ways to go at this instead of just certifying these individuals that they took a course. Maybe there are some ways that we can look at expanding the definition of who can apply the fluoride varnish. And I don't know that because we've not had a chance to explore that, actually.
Thank you. And one of the things to think about when you go back to the board is if we remove this function completely and, say, put it in DHS and public health for the certification, whether that would be an issue.
I don't think from our standpoint it's an issue. I have a finite set of staff. I've prepared my budget, which is already passed the House and is waiting in the Senate. So, I mean, I don't know. Are we talking 100 people, 500 people? I don't know. And what the class involves, we don't know any of those kind of answers either. But, you know, we're pretty much focused right now, and we do dentists, we do dental hygienists, and we do part of the dental assisting area. The counselors and health aides are not something that's been in our purview.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Cosgrove.
Very briefly, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. As Dr. Love has pointed out a couple of times, hygienists are all into prevention, and this is a preventive issue, and we are fully in support of House Bill 3017. Issues of how it should be managed or where it should be managed are up to the committee and the board to figure out, but certainly to get more of these people doing fluoride varnishes, is we highly support that expansion and hope it prevents some of the problems that these kids are suffering from. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. And we'll be back in touch as we move along. Thank you very much.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3017 and open a work session on 2773. Sandy, you want to remind us?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, subcommittee, House Bill 2773, as you recall, we had a public hearing last week on the 6th. March 6th, it creates an 8-member task force to study and assess the availability of nursing services in the Oregon schools and the feasibility of expanding the existing school nurse services. The bill also specifies and identifies the specific task force membership, requires the task force to submit a report to the appropriate interim committee no later than September 1, 2008. This has an emergency clause and is effective upon passage. At this point, once again, I do not have a fiscal impact, does not have a subsequent referral, but there is no revenue impact. And the Department of Ed in the bill is instructed to staff, provide the support staff and administrative support for this task force.
Thank you, Sandy. Since we had our public hearing, we have heard via email from the Department of Education that they are taking a neutral position on this bill. And also heard from the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. They've been working apparently with a lot of school nurses around handling of medication in the schools, medication management, and would be interested in providing technical assistance to the task force if it were convened. And Representative Gelser has also expressed interest in making sure that we also get some input from parents and advocates who work with disabled children or medically involved children to get a sense of how that might relate to our need for school nurses. Is that correct?
It is, and can I make a clarification?
Absolutely.
I think part of that, we heard some testimony that talked about that involvement, and I just wanted to point out that it's not kids with complex medical needs that drive the need for school nurses in our schools. It's more kids with chronic health conditions. We have other ways to meet the ongoing needs of those kids, and we don't need to further medicalize them.
Thank you. And I think that's a really good point. I mean, the public health function of school nurses has been affected by the limited capacity they have, and so they end up doing things that really take away from helping all the students in the schools. And so it's something to keep in mind. It's not just kids who might have some increased medical needs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regard to not having the fiscal impact, but it may have a potential fiscal impact, is that something that we should know before? When would that come out?
That's a good question.
I think it does have a significant element that we should be aware of, at least.
Well, I think that's a good question. When, you know, the Department of Education have looked at the bill. You know, one of the intents of how it was drafted was to keep it small and keep its scope reasonable. And since we haven't heard from them that they think this would take a significant amount of staff time, I would assume there'd be none or minimal. There is a school nurse position at the Department of Education, so there is a staff person who could, that's already charged with that area. So I'm assuming since they haven't said anything, we're good.
Okay. But so it's not addition. Madam Chair, thank you. It's not adding an additional team, but it's coordinating the development of this task force.
So that's the intent.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, this I would put in a request to legislative fiscal that when this moves from the subcommittee to the full committee, that we have that fiscal impact statement or a sense of that.
I forgot that we're sub.
I do. Right. Okay. I agree. So that gives us some
time.
Thank you.
So we're in work session?
So I would entertain a motion to move it to the full committee.
Madam Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2773 to the full health care committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici has moved 2773 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion? Seeing none, Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Willis.
Chair
Kotek. Aye. Seeing that we have the votes to move it on, I will carry to the full. And with that, we'll close the work session on 2773. Thank you so much. And we are adjourned.